need a few days to do this, which we're not going to take. But this is certainly a reversal of the pattern this year. Revi of B'Shalach is not at all a neglected aliyah. In fact, it is the aliyah that gives the Shabbos its name. Shabbos Shira is essentially named after Revi, so it's a rare honor for Revi this year, this week. So we have way more than enough to talk about. We really would need several sessions, so we'll have to come back in 7 years and say more. But we'll try to just highlight some of the many themes that come up in Revi of B'Shalach, and with that, actually also Shlishi, because my records indicate that for some reason we didn't have Parsha Shir last year. B'Shalach, maybe the break wasn't over yet, I don't know, but we have no indication of having discussed Shlishi. So we'll, with everything that there is to say in Revi, we have to get Shlishi in also, so we'll try to highlight as many points as possible in the time that we have. So Shlishi begins, and here the Jews are hoping to survive this encounter with the Mitzrim. And the point is really they should more than hope, because they've already been told how things are going to turn out. So it's not really a question at this point. It's more a question of their bitachon, of their faith. And therefore, it's surprisingly not a time for davening. That's what the pasuk says. Vayomer Hashem el Moshe. And here apparently Moshe is not just a reference to him, it's a reference to Moshe with everyone else, that the Jews are frantically, fervently davening, and God says, not time for it. And, you know, somewhat of a surprising reaction that you shouldn't be davening now. Don't scream at me, but pick up and move. Go ahead. And the Gemara has a discussion about this in Maseches Sota and Daf Lamed Zayin Amud Aleph, that essentially HaKadosh Baruch Hu was saying to them that this is not a time for being Mayrich B'Tfilah. From the Pasuk, it's not so obvious that it's talking about Tfilah, Ma Titzakai, like, it simply means, you know, why are you screaming at me? Just do something about it. But even though the screaming wasn't Stam screaming, but was Tfilah, still there's a time for Tfilah and there's a time for going. And this is what you have to do, pick up and move. And that whole notion of it's now your time to do something is really very much the theme of Shiras Hayam, and very much the theme of Kriyas Yamsuf, and the theme of the end of Pesach. Like the idea that the beginning of Pesach and the end of Pesach kind of form two separate Yom Tovim, with two separate historical events being commemorated. Obviously, they're connected events, but they have their own independent identities. The extent to which they're connected events is actually a topic of Machlokas. It was Machlokas, the Magen Avraham, the Shagas Aryeh, and others, about the obligation to say Yetzias Mitzrayim, to remember Yetzias Mitzrayim, to mention it every day, maybe twice a day. So can one fulfill this obligation through mentioning Kriyas Yamsuf? Do we assume that they're all one event, or is there a difference between the two? So clearly there is a difference in focus, that the end of Pesach is devoted to commemorating Kriyas Yamsuf, and there is a suggestion that we'll get to a little bit more, that Kriyas Yamsuf has maybe a higher stature than Yetzias Mitzrayim, that Yetzias Mitzrayim was as magnificent and as earth-shattering as it was. It's essentially a passive experience for the Jews who were passed over. And therefore, that's fantastic, but it's not the same as Kriyas Yamsuf, where we were actively involved in a display of Amuna, we jumped in, and that's very much the theme of this Aliyah and this Shabbos and this end of Pesach, everything connected to Kriyas Yamsuf. So, Daber al Bnei Yisrael, v'Yisrael, move, and the Shira that we'll soon read about. So Salvechik commented that the Shira that we find particularly associated with this phase, more than with the Exodus itself, has to do with this idea that not only are we grateful to HaKadosh Baruch Hu for saving us, but for allowing us to partner in the experience. That is its own unique justification for Shira, and that's again one of the themes that is hanging over this entire section of the Torah. So just to point out one other pasuk in this Aliyah. So you see here, just to continue in between. So God says, "Ataharim es matcho neteyas yadcha aliyam v'ka'ehu." We have Ovan Yeshal Basolcha Yam Biabasha. So here you see the Jews went into the middle of the water even before it was dry. And God says, I'm going to split it. Vani Hinmi Mechazek is Lev Mitzrayim. You hear that expression again. We've seen all through the past few parshios that the Mitzrayim are emboldened to keep going despite all of the indications that they're not going to prevail. Yavo Achareyim Vi Kabda Befaro V'chol Chelo B'rachbo V'farashav. This whole notion that now the hardening of their hearts is a part of the Kiddush Hashem, a part of the display of God's power here, that really, rationally, they should have given up a while ago, but they are given the ability to persevere through this so that they could get slapped around even more, so that God's magnificence will be displayed. We didn't really discuss so much this year about the whole philosophical debate about what does it mean to harden somebody's heart, how is that consistent with the idea of free will. So among the suggestions that you find is that really this is what enabled the Mitzrayim to have free will, that if they were just going to make their decisions based on this shellacking, as the president would say, that they've been getting from God, so that would be somewhat like coercion. That wouldn't really be their free will. And that the ability to withstand the makos and everything that's going on is what actually preserves their free will. So in any event, the fact is, so here they're pushing far beyond what you would have thought would be reasonable, and all of that contributes to the display of God's power here. So now the pasuk makes reference to an angel, Vayisa Malach Elokim Haolech Lefnei Machane Yisrael Vayelech Miachareihem Vayisa Amud Hanan Lefneihem Viamod Miachareihem Viyavo Bein Machane Mitzrayim Bein Machane Yisrael Vayhi Hanan Veachoshech Viyaras Halayla Volokarav Del Zer Kol Halayla. That they did not come near each other all night. So Chazal understand that this is a reference to the Malachim, that the Malachim wanted to get together, they wanted to sing Shira, they wanted to declare their praise of God. And the Gemara says in Megillah and Daf Yod that they were told not to. And that Kadosh Baruch Hu said, it's not a time to sing Shira. Ma'asa yodai tovim bayam, v'atem sharim Shira. That here, my creations, the Mitzrim, are drowning. And you think this is a good time to sing Shira? This is a good time to be unabashedly happy? So this is a very important idea, the idea that there is a recognition of the cost, a recognition of the loss, even though it comes through the enemy, even though it's the Mitzrim who are drowning, who have caused so many problems, but still there's a recognition that this is not a moment for pure, unadulterated joy. And that's what we find also at the Seder, the spilled wine, that recognizes that loss. There is a alternative interpretation, which is really not the way everyone else understood it. There's a sefer called Chanukah Satorah. It was written by the Rebbe Reb Heschel. The Chanukah Satorah always has very creative interpretations of everything. It puts together ideas in ways that you're not expecting them. So he said that the Masa Yodai Tov Bayam is not talking about the Mitzrim, it's actually talking about the Jews. That the idea of singing Shira, it's really a radical reinterpretation. He says the Malachim wanted to sing Shira not as praise to God, but as a weapon. That we find that by Sancheriv's troops, that they were all zapped by this death ray Shira that the Malachim are capable of. They could sing in a way that would cause them to all get destroyed. So they wanted to do that also. They wanted to destroy the Mitzrim with their lethal Shira. And God said, no, you can't, because I function Midah Keneged Midah, and here the Mitzrim, they drowned the Jewish babies, so therefore Midah Keneged Midah, they also have to be drowned in the ocean. So Masa Yodai Tovim B'Yam, according to him, is that the Jewish babies were drowning in the ocean, so Midah Keneged Midah, that's what has to happen to the Mitzrim also. But that is not at all the mainstream interpretation of this statement in Chazal. The common interpretation is that this is a recognition that even the Mitzrim are drowning. That's also something that has to be factored in and that has to be acknowledged in the Beis Yosef. And Siman Tafzari quotes the Medrash Harninu to make the point that that is why we don't say full Hallel on the last days of Pesach, that we only say Chatzi Hallel because we don't want to sing Shira when the Mitzrayim died. So that's a topic of discussion. The Torah Tamima has a comment over here. He says he doesn't like that. He doesn't think that that's really pshat. He doesn't say like the Chanukah Torah. He thinks the Gemara is talking about the Mitzrayim. That part he acknowledges. But he says that's not a reason not to say Hallel on the last days of Pesach, because Hallel was said then, or Shira was said then, that Moshe Rabbeinu and the Jews, they sang Shira the next day. That's what the whole Shabbos is about. So maybe it wasn't appropriate to sing Shira at the moment that the Mitzrayim were drowning. But to say that on the rest of the days, in the future years, you can't have Hallel on that day because of that, that seems to be inconsistent with the notion of Shira that was recited that very day. So you have to assume, he thinks, that maybe there's another interpretation. It's talking about just at the time that they were drowning, but doesn't have to disqualify all Hallel in future years because of that. So he doesn't go as far as the Chumash Torah and say it's not talking about the Mitzrayim. He certainly acknowledges that there is some type of acknowledgement of the Mitzrayim drowning that requires our attention, but he doesn't think that it's enough reason not to say Hallel. And he says, besides that, the Gemara says in Maseches Erchin that the reason we say Hallel fully every day of Sukkot, but not every day of Pesach, is because Sukkot is different in that Chalukim b'Korbanos Seyin, that every day of Sukkot you have different Korbanos, so therefore Sukkot, it's as if every day is its own Yontif, and therefore every day is a new Machayev of Hallel, while when it comes to Pesach, it's all one idea, so therefore we don't have, it's all one Korban, so we don't have a new obligation of Hallel every day. So the Torah Tamima says, okay, so there you have it. So that's the real reason. It's not this reason that Beis Yosef is associating with this Gemara Maseches Megillah. Now, there are others who address that question, why we have two reasons, and they don't think it's necessarily problematic. That they assume that, for example, one of the common approaches you find in the Achronim is that we need two answers as to why you say an incomplete Hallel on Pesach, on the last days of Pesach, because there are two different potential machayvim of Hallel. But in general, when we say Hallel, there are different reasons why we say Hallel, different kinds of Hallel. That there is Hallel for Yontif, which, for example, we extend as a minig to Rosh Chodesh, but because it's in the Yontif category, on the level of minig. And there's also Hallel on Neis. So Pesach, we could argue, maybe should have Hallel for two reasons. Should have Hallel because it's Yontif, and therefore, just like every other Yontif, it deserves to have Hallel. And it should have Hallel on Neis, like we say at the Seder. At the Seder, we recite Hallel. That's not in the Yontif category. That's in the category of Hallel on Neis. So for these two reasons, you could ask, okay, so then why don't we say Hallel fully the rest of the days of Pesach? So they suggest that the Gemara that says Chalukim Korbanos Seyim, that's talking about the Yontif component. That Sukkot gets Hallel every day because it's like every day is a different Yontif, while Pesach doesn't have that chop to it. And in terms of Al Hanes, that maybe you should say, have a Hallel for the first days for Yetzias Mitzrayim itself, and a Hallel the last days for Kriyas Yamsuf. So that's what the Gemara says, that Masa Yodai Tovim B'Yam, it's not appropriate to say Shira. So within that perspective, you could answer why they have two different reasons to respond to the Torah Tumimah's question. And the Torah Tumimah also says that he thinks that it's hard to know if you're going to say that we shouldn't be singing Shira at all, so then what's the point of half Hallel? So presumably the point is that we're not necessarily saying that Shira is completely uncalled for. Clearly there's a big Nasir, and therefore the Shira recognizes that. But there's also a need to have some type of acknowledgement that there is some kind of suffering going on by others. So therefore the idea of half Hallel perhaps accomplishes that well, that it's basically like spilling a little bit of wine, it's like a gesture. Now we say that on the one hand we are grateful for how we were saved, but we leave a little bit out as recognition that there is a loss here, that there is a human cost. There are other explanations of the difference between Chatzi Hallel and Full Hallel, but this is probably a adequate approach as well, that we're saying Hallel, but we leave out a little bit in recognition of the fact that there was a cost to it. Hi.
Hanukkah, we say, you know, full home.
Right.
And that seems to be celebrating also a loss of lives. And it's also often these.
It depends. Yeah, it depends how you characterize the nace of Hanukkah. The nace was specifically, if you want to say the nace was the Muhammad, you're saying, so therefore it's about... Right, that's an interesting question. You know, here it's, we're talking specifically about the Mitzrim being drowned through the process of Kriyas Yamsuf, so it's really intertwined within the whole endeavor. I hear where the question's coming from, but maybe there is room still to distinguish that maybe the involvement is not as absolute. This idea you find elsewhere in Halacha as well. You know, the Rashba writes, the Rashba has a tshuva about why there's no bracha on Misas Bezdin. There's a mitzvah in the Torah of Biarta Rav Mikrabecha, so why shouldn't there be a bracha? So there he writes, remember correctly, that again, the same idea that if somebody is going to be punished, somebody's going to die, so even though that's a kiyum mitzvah, it's not one that we want to make a bracha on. And there are those who quote that idea and say, to connect the end of the parsha to this, so the end of the parsha read about the attack of Amalek, so we have a mitzvah to remember Amalek, so the question why there's no bracha on that, so some point to this as well, and they say that it involves death, you know, remembering Amalek is connected to Melchemes Amalek, so too it involves killing people, so therefore we don't want to make a bracha on such a thing, in the same vein. Even though one could distinguish, one could say that there's a difference between a bracha and halal. A bracha just recognizes that something's a mitzvah, so you recite brachos on mitzvos because of the commandment, while shira is an expression of joy, so you could see why I write. So shira maybe is not appropriate, but a bracha doesn't necessarily reflect the same type of celebration. But nonetheless, this is an approach some take based on this idea that just like we are restrained in saying halal on the last days of Pesach, so too we are restrained in making brachos on concepts that involve the suffering of someone else. It's a very important idea that the Bali Musar have. It's always important to point out that Moshe Rabbeinu, we'll read about it in a few weeks, Moshe Rabbeinu, when he is told to make the second set of luchos, so Kadosh Baruch Hu says, Psalucha, Shnei Luchos Avonim Karishonim, that you should make these luchos this time yourself. You should recognize how expensive these luchos are. You can't just toss them off the side of a mountain. It's not a simple thing. And the Medrash is hard to understand because it sounds like it's a criticism of Moshe. It sounds like Moshe did something wrong by throwing the luchos off. And Chazal and every other source tells us that Moshe was right, that we say, Saluchos Asher Shibarta, Yashikoach Shashibarta, that Moshe did what had to be done. So the Bali Musar explained that it's not a contradiction, that Moshe did what had to be done, that was right, but he still has to recognize that there's a cost when you make a hard decision, when you have to take a negative action against someone or something important. So even if that's the necessary decision, there's still a cost. And it's not a contradiction to have both emotions at the same time. It's not a contradiction to be grateful for the Yeshua and also to be cognizant of what was lost. So Moshe was being told, not that he was criticized for breaking the luchos then, that was correct, but he should have recognized that there is something that was missing. So psalacha, you should make this luchos, you should know what it is that went into this. And they explain in the same vein the whole idea that Yaakov was criticized for hiding Dina from Esav. A difficult idea to understand at all, that if he was wrong to not let Dina marry Esav, maybe she would have had an impact on him. It's clearly strange advice, right? You would think that any sane father would want to keep his daughter away from somebody like Esav. We don't tell people who are looking for a shidduch for their daughters that, oh, you should try to find the worst possible guy you can, because that way your daughter will have a good impact on him. And the better your daughter is, the more you should try to find the worst possible guy. Clearly, that's not the advice that we give to fathers looking for shidduchim for their daughters. So the notion seems to be, like the Bali Musar explained, the same thing, that Yaakov made the right decision. But he should still feel a little bit bad about Esav losing out on what potentially could have turned him around. And that's also something that has to be recognized. So Chazal, we're criticizing that. So it's possible to have both emotions at the same time. It's possible to say half halal, possible to say the Hallel that recognizes that you were saved, and at the same time a half Hallel, there's a little bit that's held back because there is also something that had to pay, there is someone who had to suffer for it, so that should also be acknowledged. Okay, so, yes sir?
We do have a concept, it seems, of rejoicing at the fall of an enemy.
Yeah, it's a very extensive discussion about when is that appropriate, is that appropriate, are there different kinds of enemies, are there different kinds of rejoicing. So this is a part of the discussion. You know, do we say on the one hand, folivacha al tismach, on the other hand, b'ibur v'shayim mina, what exactly is a lot that's been written about trying to reconcile and to try to figure out what exactly is the correct balance between these two ideas. So without going into all the makaris, it's just a little bit of the idea that it's possible to have both. You know, it's possible to recognize that there is Yeshua, which also involves, it's very much a theme throughout the Yetzias Mitzrayim, which also involves defeating evil. But at the same time, the human beings who are associated with evil have to be a source of sympathy also. And that's a big point, that it's possible to separate the human beings and the evil with which they are connected. Not necessarily practically. It's not necessarily practically possible to separate them, so sometimes there has to be a physical downfall. But one can have a sense of compassion for the human suffering even within the body that is participating in this evil that has to be wiped out. Which, in essence, is probably also the end of the parsha, which we'll have to wait a few years to get up to, but the whole notion of Amalek and the idea that Amalek has to be remembered and wiped out completely. So Amalek represents a certain degree of irredeemable evil. But that's about the concept of Amalek. The individuals possibly can be redeemed, because the position of the Rambam and others is that you can accept Gerim from Amalek. So it's possible to say that you can have Rachmanis on human beings, but not on the evil that they're associated with. So Amalek itself is irredeemable, but it's theoretically possible for a human being to separate themselves from Amalek. And it's the same kind of idea that we theoretically have to be very nuanced and subtle in terms of understanding how these different parts are at tension with each other. Ari?
Amalek was, in theory, a specific person of Amalek could be redeemable.
Mm-hmm.
And why would Shaul have been so... why would Shaul have been chastised so much for letting the king of Amalek live?
Because,
and why wouldn't Hashem then say, oh, let him live, and then maybe we'll redeem him?
Because it's not enough to say that maybe he's redeemable, that if a person does choose to leave Amalek, so then theoretically then they could lose that status. But Holzman, that they are part of Amalek, then they represent this danger to the world, which presumably is a big part of why they are targeted for such an attitude. There's a lot more to say about that, but we're not up to Shvi, but just mentioning it only as it's related to this point. In any event... So just to look a little bit more at this aliyah before going on to the big revi. So Pasuk of Bay says, Vayavo b'nei Yisrael b'sol chayam v'yabasha, v'mayim lehem choma, miminam v'mismalam. The water was like a wall on the right and on the left. And Chazal explained with Mar Yuma that there were paths that were made, actually 12 paths, one, you know, with 13 paths, you know, one for each shevet. And the idea, some suggest, Tartim has a comment there also, that maybe the notion was that it specifically had to happen in this very wall-like way, rather than just having the water kind of dissipate in different directions and letting the people safely walk over it, is in order to counter the idea that this wasn't miraculous. You know, if the water had just kind of dried up, so it could look like this was a receding tide, it could look like this was some type of natural phenomenon, and therefore, in order to make the nace clear, so it had to happen in a way that looks completely unnatural. And this is a big topic of discussion. You know, those who would suggest that the nisim that are described in the Torah can be explained by physical phenomena. So this is something that Rav Shamsher and Fal Hirsch discusses at length in this particular section of the Torah, and it's always a big topic of debate. So here the suggestion is that it's specifically done in a way that shouldn't look like it could have been a natural occurrence. Okay, yeah?
don't know if you probably you seem not to want to enter the topic, but
okay.
But the Rambam in because we're moving on, but the yes. Rambam in Parash and Meshechta Ta'avos praises the rabbis for saying that some of the miracles and extended to many of the miracles are built into creation. Mm. So he seems to support the idea that they are. Natural
built into creation, meaning that they, from the time of the creation of the world,
right,
that this
exactly.
was right, right, which doesn't necessarily mean that they are natural occurrences in the same way. You know, the way that those who want to diminish the nace quality are saying, well, it just happened to be that there's an eclipse, that there's a tide, that there's a this, that God's not really doing anything particularly for the Jews. So that's what Rav Hirsch and others are discussing, is a specific attempt to minimize the involvement of God in how this is happening, and that's where there is objection. Akiva?
But
there
is from Soloveitchik in Emergence of the Romantics, also discussed this, and his stuff there actually is strikingly accepting of the idea that there might be scientific explanation for the miracles as they happen. That doesn't necessarily mean that God was
So the question all comes with the attitude. So now is the attitude to say that, okay, this just happened and therefore it's basically a coincidence, or saying that the same way, you know, you find the same discussion, you know, with evolution and other things like that, you know, so what is your approach towards evolution? Are you saying that this is a Kodesh Baruch Hu's way of directing creation? Are you saying that this is a way of removing God from the equation? So you could essentially address the same type of mahalach and have different attitudes and different ways of expressing it and different intents in expressing it, and that's a part of where the debate lies. Okay, so a lot more to say about that, but we want to talk about Ravi a little bit. So Ravi is the Aliyah of Shira. So here God tells Moshe, "Vayomer Hashem Moshe Netei Yisyadcha Hayam V'Yashuvu Hamayim Al Mitzrayim." Al Rukbo v'al Parashav v'yed Moshe asiyada v'alayam v'yashav hayam l'fnos boker le'isono u'mitzrayim nosim l'korso v'yinar Hashemes Mitzrayim b'soch hayam. So here's what happens, the Kriya of Yamsuf, and it has a tremendous effect on the Mitzrayim, a tremendous effect on the Jews, and on the whole world. So much so that we get to the Shira of the first Pasuk of Parshas of Perek Tezvav, Oz Yashir Moshe. Now it's interesting, there is a discussion to be had about the obligation of Shnai Mikra V'Yechad Targum. So a question about whether you can be Yotzei Shnai Mikra V'Yechad Targum without Kavana, incidentally. So Poskim talk about if you teach children the Parsha, so you tend to go through the Parsha anyway, so could that count as Shnai Mikra V'Yechad Targum? So too, this week, so you say the Shira Sayam every day, maybe that should count for some point of Shnai Mikra V'Yechad Targum. But in any event, so we say this Shira every day. Oz Yashir Moshe, the wonderful world of Oz. There's a lot of attention that's paid to that Oz, because the Medrash says that word is significant. That Moshe Rabbeinu was essentially doing tshuva, says the Medrash, that he had complained, that he said to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that may Oz basi al Paro, that from that time when you sent me to go to Paro, so all you've done is bad things for this people, the people have suffered, and things haven't worked out, and now he's doing tshuva for that with Oz Yashir. So the Beis HaLevi has an important drasha about this, where he discusses, you know, really what's the significance. It's just a linguistic choice, you know, so you use the word Oz here, the word Oz there. What really does that have to do with anything? How is that any kind of a kapara that, oh, I said something not so nice, and I used the word Oz, so now I'm saying something nice, and I'm also using the word Oz, so that should be mechaper for that. How exactly does it really help? So the Beis HaLevi explained that when people are happy about things, let's say if somebody, Chalila, gets sick, and then they recover, so they're happy. So why are they happy? So there's two different ways you could be happy. One way to be happy is that you're not sick anymore. You don't want to be sick, so that was a time of sadness. And now that you're better, so now you're happy because you're not sick anymore. But there is a deeper way to be happy, that not only are you happy because you're not sick, but you also recognize that the whole experience, even including the time when you were sick, that was also all for the best. That also contributed to your spiritual growth and to your development. And so you're happy not only for the refuah, but you're even grateful for the whole experience that led up to it. So says the Beis Halevi, that's what Moshe is saying here, that the Oz, which is a big topic of discussion in the Farshim, Oz is a word referring to time, whether it means then, the future, now. It's a little bit subject to much interpretation how Oz should be perceived, but Oz is a reference to shifting time periods, and that essentially we're saying that not only is the Shira on today's miracle, not only is the Shira on Kriyas Yamsuf, but the recognition that everything is a part of that, that even the Shibud is a part of this miraculous development, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu's glory, which is being transmitted to the world and is being conveyed to the Jewish people who are going to be the standard bearers, that happened not only because of a miracle today, but because of everything that led up to it, that the Shibud was also a part of that process. So I recognize now, says Moshe, that when I said, Me'oz Basi El Paro, that originally everything was bad, no, that even that was bad was also part of the process, was also something I should be makir tov for. So I atone for my lack of appreciation then with an expression of appreciation now that specifically includes that event from the past as a part of its expression. But again, Oz has a connotation also of the future, so the Gemara says in Sanhedrin that this is one of the sources for Tchias HaMesim and HaTorah, because the language is, assuming that this is what it means, that Oz Yashir could also be read as, in the future, Moshe will sing. So how is the Torah telling us that Moshe will sing in the future? So it's a recognition of the fact that there's going to be continued glory given to God because of this event, even in the future. And at this point, Moshe is no longer alive. So if we're going to say that he's going to do this in the future, so we're talking about Tchias HaMesim alluded to in the Torah. But it's also a reference, if you do the math and you put the parts together, so it's also a recognition that Kriyas Yamsuf is even a bigger deal than Yetzias Mitzrayim itself. Because the Gemara in the end of the first parak of Brachos suggests that even though we focus on Yetzias Mitzrayim now as a major event that we have to commemorate, but the Gemara says eventually we're going to forget about it, that eventually the redemption is going to be such a big deal that it's going to overwhelm even Yetzias Mitzrayim, that right now Yetzias Mitzrayim is the biggest thing we have to focus on, but after Mashiach comes, it's not going to necessarily have as prominent a place in our memory. So it sounds like Yetzias Mitzrayim is not always going to be the topic of discussion, but apparently Kriyas Yamsuf will, because here, Oz Yashar, even after Tchias HaMesim, we're still going to sing about Kriyas Yamsuf. So that's another statement that Kriyas Yamsuf is given a significance that even Yetzias Mitzrayim doesn't have. And that also is connected by many to the idea that the human involvement gives it a whole other level of connection. It also could be said, and the Rashiv Karambiavna of Holvich discusses something along these lines in his Sichos, that the idea that the human involvement is present also is what makes something longer lasting. That when you're the passive recipient of a miracle, so it's impressive when it's in front of you, but ultimately when circumstances change, so then it's not necessarily the focus of attention. But when you have worked through something yourself, when you've done all the marmakomos before this year, and you've gone through everything on your own, so that has a much greater staying power, that becomes a part of you in a different way, and that becomes something that is much longer lasting. So Klal Yisrael is much more involved in Kriyas Yamsuf than in Yetzias Mitzrayim. So Kriyas Yamsuf, there is a eternal kinyan. There is something that lasts and becomes a part of our consciousness forever. And that's also being referenced here. The pasuk says, Ashira LaHashem Ki Goga, that I will sing to God because of His exaltedness. What it sounds like it means, but ki, as Rashi alludes to, ki has different meanings, and ki could also mean the opposite. It can mean because, and it could mean that the opposite of because. It can mean despite of, the opposite of what should happen because of this. So Rav Soloveitchik discussed these two possibilities, and he notes that It could mean that I'm grateful to God for what he did, or it could mean that I will sing to God even though I can't really chap him. He's so beyond me, he's so exalted that it's beyond my capacity to express, but I have to say something. So despite the fact that he's so exalted, I will still Ashir El Hashem, I still will say something. So now the next pasuk, a very crucial pasuk, which we really could easily spend the rest of the time and beyond talking about, but we'll just try to keep it contained for a few minutes. And the pasuk says, Aziv Zimraska, that God is my strength and my song, Vayhi Lishua, like you say that at Havdalah, and he will be my salvation. But the rest of the pasuk is particularly well known, Zeh Keli V'Anveyu Elokei Avi Romimenu. So, Elokei Avi Romimenu, that we're following in the path of our forefathers, that our forefathers recognize God and we will also exalt him. Some suggest that this is also our heter, so to speak, for praising God, despite what we said a pasuk ago, that he's too exalted for us, but our forefathers managed to find a way to express his greatness, so we're going to follow in their path. We're not starting this on our own, we're just continuing this path that our forefathers did. But what about the middle of this pasuk? Zeh Keli V'Anveyu. So what does that mean? What does that pasuk mean? So it's hard to translate what Anveyu means. There are a couple of different interpretations. Herman Wouk wrote a book called This Is My God. So he left out the hard part. So what's the next word? So V'Anveyu. So how do you translate that? So usually the word comes from the word meaning a place, that I will build him a residence, and that's how some of the Targum translate this, that Evni Le Mikdasha, and that we find throughout the Shir HaSayam here references to the ultimate establishment of the Beis HaMikdash as the step that this is a progression towards. But Chazal and the Gemara Masechet Shabbos and Daf Kuf Lamed Gimel have two other interpretations. So one, for our synergy purposes, is one that we've been talking about for the past week. When we talk about staka, so we say that the obligation of staka and of chesed, one of the two tracks that we've been talking about is the idea of v'halachta b'drachav, that we have an obligation of chesed, and that obligation is because we want to imitate God, imitati odei. So that's one explanation the Gemara has of this pasuk, that we say, zeh keli v'anveihu, we want to be like God. The way Rashi understands it, it means the word is ani vahu. Anveihu means me and him, he and him together, I will be like God. So mahu racham v'chan and afata racham v'chan. Some of the Mefarshim say that we recognize that we were the recipients of chesed at that point. God just did this tremendous service to us, so we want to be like him. We want to also provide service and benefit to the world in a similar fashion. So this is one of the makoros for chesed. Next week's parsha and parsha's Yisro and the instruction to Moshe Rabbeinu, maybe we'll have a chance to talk about that. There's also a reference to chesed in Yisro's advice to Moshe. And then ultimately we'll find v'halachta b'drachav as a mitzvah several times in Sefer Dvarim, as we mentioned. So some of the Svarim suggest that there's kind of a progression here, that the Jews are saying, wow, we want to be like God, we want to be people of chesed. That was a spontaneous declaration upon receiving this miraculous benefit. And then Yisro tells Moshe, you know, it's a good idea for a society to be a society of chesed. You're going to have many fewer fights and you won't have to have so many dinei Torah for you to adjudicate. And then ultimately the Torah commands it as a mitzvah. And ultimately it gets its own mitzvah status as a directive of halachta b'drachav. But in any event, this is one of the notions that's associated with this pasuk, that we should be like God, and therefore we should be people of kindness and compassion. And then the Gemara has another possible interpretation, that v'anveihu comes from the language of nava, that I will make it beautiful, so it means I will make God beautiful. So asks the Gemara, how in the world are you going to do that? How are you going to make God beautiful? So the suggestion is that this is a reference to the concept of hiddur mitzvah, that you should have beautiful mitzvah objects, as the Gemara, tzitzis na, tefillin na, sefer Torah na, you should have beautiful items of the mitzvah. That's the fulfillment of the idea of zeh keli v'yan ve'yu. So it seems like that's another track, that's another interpretation. The Torah Temima has a very important comment on this pasuk, where he says that maybe it's not really a separate track of interpretation. That he thinks that the idea that you have hiddur mitzvah, maybe that's really the pshat in the pasuk, and the idea that it's about v'halachta b'drachim, you should be like God in your midos, and you should be kind and compassionate, just like God is. So he notes that, yes, Rashi understands it because of anivahu, but maybe that's not the way we should interpret it. Maybe it's all the idea of navehu, we should beautify God. So how do you beautify God? You beautify God by Kiddush Hashem, by showing that you have internalized midos that impress people. So the idea that you have to be shalim in your ben adam l'chavero and your ben adam l'makom, that is the necessary message of the pasuk. So it's all one drasha. So essentially, the pasuk of Anvehu, of making God beautiful, is telling us do mitzvos ben adam l'makom in a beautiful way, and do your mitzvos ben adam l'chavero in a beautiful way, in a way that is reflective of God himself. And then he says it backwards also. He says that you could even say that it means, yes, you should have beautiful rituals and beautiful mitzvos ben adam l'makom, but that's not going to make anybody happy if you're also a jerk at the same time, if you're not a kind and compassionate person. So then that's not going to be too effective as a act of hiddur mitzvah. And if you're going to do a hiddur mitzvah in the complete sense, you have to have both of these drushas together. And that's perhaps what the Gemara is getting at. So maybe just to say a few words about this concept of hiddur mitzvah. Well, I don't have that much time, but just to say a little bit about how it is discussed lahalacha and in lamdas. So the Gemara does have this drasha, and it's a machlokas among the Rishonim whether it's a drasha gemura, is that really a didman haTorah of hiddur mitzvah, or is it a asmachta? Should we assume that hiddur mitzvah is really a din midrabanan? So that was a machlokas among the Rishonim. And there are those who feel that that's also the machlokas in the Gemara Maseches Bava Kamma and Daf Tes, that the Gemara there discusses how should you know how much to commit to a hiddur mitzvah. Let's say you have an esrog, and the esrog costs you $30. And then you have a fancy esrog that's available also, and that's going to cost you $300. It's going to cost you 10 times as much. So should you go for the fancy esrog? So it sounds like from the Gemara that no, that's disproportionate. You only have to add on a fraction. You only have to add on a little bit, not a multiple. So what's the fraction? So the Gemara calls it a shlish, which would normally translate to a third. You'd think that would mean 33%. So if the basic esrog costs $30, you should be ready to spend $40 for the nicer esrog. But there's a machlokas in the Gemara about this, about milvar, milagav, that is it a third from the inside or from the outside. The other opinion is you shouldn't add $10, you should add $15. Because you should add 50%. Because if you add 50%, that's a third of the new total. So maybe it's a third from the outside, so to speak. So it's not resolved in the Gemara whether you add 33% or whether you add 50%. So how do we paskin? Machlokas. Some say a third, some say a half. So the later svarim say that the machlokas is about this issue, that if you assume that it's an unresolved point, so it's a safek, so if it's a din derabanan, we could be mekel and use the smaller number, and if it's a din min haTorah, we could be machmir and use the higher number. So maybe that's what the whole machlokas is about, whether hiddur mitzvah is a doraisa or a derabanan. And similarly, the Ritva, Maseches Sukkah, and Dafid Aleph, the Ritva suggests that we're talking about a din derabanan here, because he says if hiddur mitzvah was a din min haTorah, it would have to be ma'akev. It would have to be that you can't be yotze the mitzvah without it. He's working off a premise that some of the Rishonim have, that any din daraisa has to be ma'akev. There's no such thing as the chachila and the b'dieved on a level min haTorah. It's only when you're dealing with drabanans that you have a good way to do it and a better way to do it. But min haTorah, all the mitzvahs are all or nothing. So says the Ritva, if hiddur mitzvah is not ma'akev, so then it must be that it's drabban. So the truth is, you could question that a little bit, and you could pose the following question. You know, what exactly is this notion of hiddur mitzvah? Why do we have such a concept? Why is it that we're told by the halacha that hidden mitzvah is worthwhile? So we could suggest the following two possibilities. You could say that either it's an expression of commitment and enthusiasm, like you find elsewhere. We have a concept of mitzvah bo yosu mi b'shlucho, that it's better if you do a mitzvah yourself with your own personal involvement than have somebody else do it. We have a concept of zrizin makdima l'mitzvos, that it's better for you to do a mitzvah quickly rather than to let it get stale. So maybe this is the same kind of thing, that you should do the mitzvah with enthusiasm, so do it the best way possible. That's what hidden mitzvah means. Or we could say that no, it doesn't mean that. That this is a notion that all the major world religions have come onto, that the religious symbols in the world, whether it's the house of worship itself, whether it's the various implements and kelim that are used, should be beautiful, because that's a way of drawing respect to the religion. And if you have a beautiful shul or any other type of religious entity, so people tend to be impressed with this physical attractiveness and associated with the glory of the religion. So then maybe we have the same idea that that's what the hidden mitzvah is meant to accomplish. So if it's the first one, that it's about enthusiasm, so we could say really it's not about this mitzvah, it's a general principle that we should express enthusiasm and commitment in the mitzvahs in the way we do them, and we should do them ourselves, we should do them quickly, we should do them perfectly and nicely. All of that is about how you do mitzvahs. While if it's about the mitzvah should be beautiful, so then it could be that every mitzvah then is a physical representation. So there's a clause that it should also be done in a beautiful way. So maybe we could say, as far as the Ritva's point, that if it's min haTorah, it has to be ma'akev. So we could say that, yes, if it's a detail of this mitzvah, then it has to be ma'akev in order for it to be a din min haTorah. But maybe it's not a detail of each individual mitzvah. The mitzvahs have their own rules, and those rules are all ma'akev. But there's separate from that an instruction to the individual that he should do things behider, and therefore that means that when possible, he's going to try to do things in the most beautiful way possible. So this could be the topic of many other debates among the Rishonim, just to very quickly allude to some of them, that there is also a machlokas about the Gemara that I just told you a few minutes ago in Bava Kamma and Daf Tes. So when I said it's about how much money you add to spend on a better esrog, so there are other interpretations in Rishonim. I just told you Rashi's interpretation, that it's about how much you spend. But Tosfos says differently. Tosfos says that it means, let's say you have a small esrog that's kosher, and you have an opportunity to buy a bigger esrog. So how much bigger should you get? Should you get one that's 10 times the size? So Tosfos says, no, that's already disproportionate. Get one that's a third bigger. So what's this machlokas about how much you spend or about how impressive the item is? So that seems to be these two possibilities. It's about how much you are committing to the endeavor, that your willingness to spend more is an indication of your commitment and devotion, which others don't even know about. It's only between you and God how devoted you are, assuming that you're not coming to shul and bragging about how much you spent on your esrog, but it's really just about what you express to you and God. While if it's about one-third bigger, regardless of how it costs, then it's really about the impression it makes on everyone else, and that's how we're evaluating hitters. So that could reflect that machlokas. It's also machlokas among the Rishonim, Tosfos, Maseches Menachos, and others, about we have a notion of hidr by a Sefer Torah. A Sefer Torah has to be written beautifully, and has to have a sirta, it has to have underline in it, which some understand is a function of hidr. So there was a machlokas among the Rishonim. So what about, let's say, the parshiyos of the tefillin shaliyah? Do they also have to be beautiful the same way Sefer Torah has to be beautiful? So that was a machlokas. So what's the issue? The issue is that Sefer Torah, so everyone sees. But parashiyos of tefillin, so nobody sees. So it's a question, is there any point in hidden mitzvah if it's not going to be visible? So it could be the same issue, that hidden mitzvah is, if it's about how you express your commitment to God, so then if you try to have nice tefillin, even if nobody's going to see it, so then that's still an expression of devotion and commitment. But if it's about impressing other people, so then it only makes sense to do that by something that's going to be seen and not by something that's going to be hidden away. Hi.
Another way to put it would be maybe if you live on a desert island and you have a choice between a esrog or something like that.
Yeah, that could also be, but it's, I guess it's easier to have the scenario of having tefillin because that it comes with far fewer sacrifices than moving to a desert island to test it.
Describe, nobody's going to be able
right,
to
right, you can come up with other scenarios. Right, you can come up with other scenarios, but this one's a little bit more common. But, but yes, I agree that that would also be, that would also possibly illustrate the situation. In general, also, there are those who suggest, this would take much longer to explain in detail, but just to allude to it quickly, that a number of Achronim think that there's a machlokus between the Rambam and the other Rishonim about whether Hiddur Mitzvah has to be specifically with the initial performance of the Mitzvah, or could it be added on later. And just to phrase that a little bit differently, that perhaps the machlokus, to the extent that that exists, is Hiddur about how you do a Mitzvah, again, that you should do it with enthusiasm, or is it about the presentation of the mitzvah, which is meant to impress other people, and therefore perhaps could be added on later, even separate from your initial action? So if the Rambam indeed holds that it's all about how you do the mitzvah, so that could also be consistent with the fact that it's not clear that the Rambam ever acknowledges in Mishneh Torah a value to having beautiful mitzvah objects, the concept of hiddur mitzvah that we tend to take for granted, so it's not clear that the Rambam acknowledges that. And it could be that the Rambam understands Hiddur as exclusively about how you do something, and that that's parallel to a concept that we have elsewhere called mitzvah min hamuvchar, to try to do a mitzvah in the best possible way. That's also called Hiddur. So you find some Rishonim invoking the term Hiddur mitzvah even when there is no object to pay attention to. So, for example, Rashi and the Rashbam in the beginning of the 10th parak of Pesachim talk about that if you don't eat on Erev Pesach, so you'll be able to eat matzah with a greater appetite, and that's a hiddur mitzvah. Now there's no beautiful object, it's just that the fact that you're going to be more interested in eating this matzah eagerly, that itself is in the spirit of hiddur mitzvah. Or Tosfos in Maseches Brachos talks about answering Kedusha on your own rather than through Shemei Ka'onah, rather than listening to somebody else, and says that's also a hiddur mitzvah. Again, it's not about an object, but it's about doing a mitzvah with its perfect details. So a lot more to say about that, but there's still more psukim in this aliyah, which we won't really get to, but we'll just allude to them, and then we'll have to break for mincha. But here we have the idea, going towards the end of the aliyah, skipping all these very important psukim in the middle, but you're all familiar with them. But after Kriyas Yam Suf is over, so then there's still more to the aliyah. The pasuk continues, Vayisa Moshe es Yisrael, pasuk chavbeis, Vayisa Moshe es Yisrael mi Yam Suf, so this idea that they looked for 3 days and they couldn't find water, so the Gemara in Bava Kamma builds on this idea that water is representative of Torah, and that when you go 3 days without Torah, just like you go 3 days without water, you can't handle it, so too you can't handle going 3 days without Torah. And that's why there is a very early takana to read the Torah every 3 days, or not to let 3 days pass without reading the Torah. So we read the Torah on Shabbos, Monday, and Thursday because of this idea that there shouldn't be 3 days without Torah, just like there shouldn't be 3 days without water. And not surprisingly, so the Jews complain. So they come to Mara, v'yavo marasav lo'yachlu shtos mayim imara, ki marim heim. There's a certain theme there, right? Mara, Mara, Mara. Alkein karashmo, Mara. So therefore, top candidate for the name is Mara. A lot more to say about this, but again, we'll have to find more occasions. But Vayilonu Hamamoshe Lemor Maneshtes. So the Jews complain and they ask, "What should we drink?" Vayitzak Al Hashem Vireihu Hashem Eitz Vayashlech Al Hamayim Vayimtiku Hamayim Sham Samlo Choku Mishpat Visham Niso. So here, this miracle happens that Moshe is told to take this tree, this wood, and throw it into the water, and all of a sudden the water somehow becomes sweet. So this is not a recipe step that modern-day cooks have picked up from this. This doesn't seem to work nowadays if you try to make something bittersweet. So clearly this is miraculous, and that may be relevant to what the rest of the pasuk says. So the rest of the pasuk says that at this time at Mara, so some of the mitzvot were taught to the Jewish people, Sham Samlo Choku Mishpat. So what is the Chok and what is the Mishpat? So the Mishpat is Din. They were taught some Dinim. They were taught some of the principles of civil law, of Choshim Mishpat, and also some other mitzvos, such as Shabbos, and Rashi says also Paraduma. So what Paraduma has to do with anything is a topic of a lot of discussion. The Torah Tamima says he thinks it must be a typo. He thinks that it must be Kibbud Av, and that it was abbreviated as Chaf Aleph, and that came out unclearly, and it looked like it said Pei Aleph, so Rashi assumes that it's Paraduma, because why in the world should they be talking about Paraduma? It doesn't make sense. It must have been Kibbud Av, and Paraduma is a typo. My grandfather, Zichron Levrach, in his commentary to the Torah Tamima, and his Meshivas Nefesh, so he argues on this point. He says, later on, Rashi mentions both Kibbud Av Ve'Eim and Paraduma, so it doesn't seem like it's a typo. And there is a reason why Paraduma is there, that this is a part of the message, that just like God can take bitter water and make it sweet, so too, Paraduma also has a similar dynamic, how it can take the Tameh and make it Tar, and the Tar and make it Tameh, and that really this is an opportunity to display all of God's majesty over the world and all of its various incarnations. So we have Chukim, and we have Mishpatim, and we have commemorative mitzvos, which are really all different points along the same continuum. So we have a mitzvah like Dinim, which is all the more rationally accessible mitzvos, the Mishpatim. We have a mitzvah like Shabbos, which is not so intuitive, but we can understand it once we're told about it, because it commemorates something. And we have a mitzvah like Paraduma, which is really ultimate chok, but all of them are all points along the same continuum, that they're all points that convey the idea that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is in control of the world and behind the chukim, just like he's behind the mishpatim, just like he's behind the chukim. Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky has a beautiful observation in his Sefer Emes Liyakov, where he says that the Malachos, the Shabbos, are taught now, even though when it comes to Hotzah, we talked about this at length last year when we were learning the first parak of Shabbos, that the Malacha of Hotzah, it could be, wasn't taught until the Mishkan, as some of the Rishonim indicate. So he explains that by saying that there is a whole approach the Rishonim have, that the Malacha of Hotzah is different than all the other Malachos, that all the other Malachos are about changing something, and Hotzah doesn't involve changing something. So Shabbos basically means don't change things in the world, don't make physical changes, and there are really 38 ways of doing that. And Hotzah is on a different track, Hotzah is the 39th, but the point is that nothing seems to change. You bring something outside and take it inside, you bring something inside, take it outside, it's still the same thing. But apparently the Chiddush of Hotzah is that it changes by location. The location also has significance to your identity. So in that vein, he wanted to say that, so when it comes to Mara, so Mara was a good time to teach the basic concept of a Malacha, that idea that changing the world has to be done with a recognition that God created the world. So this was a good moment to highlight that, that here God's displaying that he has such control over everything, he can take something bitter and throw wood into it and make it sweet. Doesn't make any sense, but that's God's mastery of creation. So we can only create with that recognition. So we have to acknowledge one day a week that we won't create in recognition that God is the one who creates. But the notion of Kedushas HaMakom, the notion that location could also be a part of the identity, that the Jews were not yet ready to understand until they got to the Mishkan. The Mishkan introduced the concept of Kedushas HaMakom, that place could have such significance that that's also considered to be a significant change. So that Malacha had to wait till then. But the other Malachas were conveyed at Mara because the notion of creation and of God's creation being so significant and something that we have to recognize anytime we want to create something and hold back one day a week in order to acknowledge that, that's the notion of Shabbos that's being conveyed there. And it's in that spirit also that Paraduma is perhaps an appropriate lesson at this point too, and that could perhaps address the Torah Tamima's assumption that it doesn't seem to fit here. Maybe it does fit. Maybe the Paraduma was a message very consistent with what was going on, and that's also a response to the Jews complaining and thinking that God's not taking care of them, that he's taking care of them in ways they don't fully appreciate, and that's also part of what has to be understood. Okay, so we're just about out of time, so we'll daven mincha again. I'll see you on Sunday, and we'll continue with the priorities and stuff.